that they want to destroy.
Okay.
And this, I believe, is where this is going.
Well, given that, there's going to be some backlash, and some of it may actually turn into Charlotte Kate's Israelis who are migrating out of Israel. We're looking at already a new movement that was interesting that was created because of this great opposition towards the cabinet, calling itself Leaving Israel Altogether, planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its plan. Do you think that this is going to gain momentum? In 30 seconds, please.
It's almost certainly going to gain momentum as the reality of what Zionism means for everybody in the area continues to become apparent. Where Zionism, settler colonialism, and imperialism go, they create destruction, bloodshed, and an exploitative relationship. And so anyone who doesn't want to be a part of that has to take a stand against it. And one of those ways to take a stand against it is to stop participating in the colonization of Palestine.
Okay, thank you very much, Charlotte Kate, International Coordinator, Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Miko Pellet, thank you, author and human rights activist from Washington, D.C. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Pellet and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina tawaffahumu al-malaa'ikatu ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستضعفين من الرجال والنساء ولا يهتدون سبيلا فأولئك عسى الله أن يعفو عنهم وكان الله عفوا غفورا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious, so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the Turkish president says Sweden and Finland must extradite up to 130, quote, terrorists before Ankara approves their bids to join NATO. Thousands of nurses in England say they will strike for the third time if no progress is made in pay. And Tehran slams the South Korean president's interventionist remarks against Iran, saying it is awaiting an explanation from Seoul. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Turkey is demanding that Sweden and Finland hand over up to 130, quote, terrorists before Ankara approves their bids to join NATO. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he has warned the two countries that their accession bids would not be approved by the Turkish parliament if the terrorists are not deported. Turkey had earlier warned Sweden in particular that it must first take a clear stance against what Ankara sees as a terrorist group. They include Kurdish militants and a group that Turkey blames for a 2016 coup attempt. The two Nordic countries applied for NATO membership last year. Their request must be upheld by all 30 NATO member states. Turkey and Hungary are the two remaining members of the military alliance that have not endorsed their applications yet. Russia has produced the first set of nuclear-capable super torpedoes. Russian media say the nuclear mega submarine Belgorod will be armed with these weapons in the near future. The weapon is driven by a nuclear reactor to give the torpedo its own power source. U.S. and Russian officials have both described this as a new category of retaliatory weapons. They say it is capable of triggering a radioactive ocean tsunami that makes coastal cities uninhabitable. The U.S. government says such weapons are designed to hold the U.S. homeland or allies at risk. Back in 2018, Russian President Vladimir Putin said torpedoes are practically indestructible. The EU faces economic uncertainty in 2023 due to gas supply issues. The European Commission has acknowledged that energy sanctions against Russia are backfiring to some extent, Jerome Hughes reports.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organized 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the UK, teachers and nurses are set to go on away strikes and a fresh headache for the government. Over 23,000 schools in England and Wales will be impacted by teacher strikes planned for February the 1st. Teachers in Scotland have already stopped work, which has closed many schools. Britain's largest education union says the government offers a 5% pay rise, which is in fact a wage cut due to spiraling prices. Tens of thousands of nurses in England are also planning strikes in February. Their trade union says a stoppage will take place if progress is not made by the end of this month in pay negotiations with the government. Months of strikes across various sectors have caused widespread disruption in the UK, which is suffering from decades-high inflation. The government says it cannot afford big wage hikes. The Foreign Ministry of Iran has strongly reacted to the South Korean president calling Iran an enemy of the UAE. It slammed the comments as diplomatically invalid and meddlesome. The ministry spokesman says the remarks show a failure to fully grasp the historical and friendly relation between Iran and the Persian Gulf littoral states, including the UAE. Nasser Kanani said those relations are positive and fast-moving. He added that Iran is now awaiting an explanation from the South Korean Foreign Ministry. In the UAE on Sunday, the South Korean president alleged that Iran is the biggest threat to the Arab country. Yoon Suk-yeol made the remarks during a visit to a contingent of South Korean special forces stationed in the UAE. Meanwhile, South Koreans have questioned massive arms and nuclear deals with the United Arab Emirates boosted during the president's trip to Abu Dhabi. The UAE has already purchased a $3.5 billion worth of weapons package from South Korea. Many oppose these arms sales, saying such measures would foment conflicts in the world. Frank Smith reports.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the United Arab Emirates this week to boost trade ties. South Korea is constructing 4 nuclear reactors for the UAE as President Yoon supports a return to nuclear energy.
Korea has also declared its 2050 carbon neutrality goal. To achieve this goal, we're working to rapidly restore the nuclear power system, which supplies carbon-free electricity, and boost the supply of clean energy, such as renewable energy and hydrogen energy.
President Yoon also seeks to boost weapons exports to the UAE on the heels of a $3.5 billion deal for a South Korean anti-ballistic missile system. This despite a controversial surveillance lapse in South Korea. President Yoon and the South Korean military have been under intense criticism following a recent incursion of 5 North Korean drones across the border. President Yoon and his wife Sunday visited a detachment of South Korean soldiers stationed in the UAE since 2011. South Korea has become a major arms exporter of fighter jets, tanks, and guided missiles, which have found prominent use in the war in Yemen. South Koreans, however, view such weapons sales with caution.
It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our exports, but it's not good if those weapons are then actually used in a war.
I know that area has had a lot of conflict and war, so I think selling weapons there will just make the situation worse.
South Korea is now the world's 7th largest arms dealer with prominent exports to Southeast Asia, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Protests are continuing against the new far-right Israeli cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with thousands of students joining in. Protests were held in over a dozen university and college campuses, including in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Al-Quds. They left their classes to stage a coordinated strike against the cabinet's plans for the so-called judicial reforms. 4 students were arrested in Al-Quds, with protest organizers complaining of bullying by police forces. The new Israeli cabinet is under for its attempt to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This is amid the Prime Minister's own efforts to dodge the charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the 2nd consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, who has ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it, and we'll fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Courts in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely.
Israel is grappling with numerous issues. The regime faces the challenge posed by the rise of new Palestinian resistance groups, as well as a biting cost of living crisis and internal political divisions. All of these point to a question whether Israel is riding for a fall, especially seeing the comments by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who warned back in May that the regime could disintegrate before its 80th anniversary.
In office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said the move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
In the US, a cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors was killed by Los Angeles police after he got in a traffic accident and police officers who showed up repeatedly tased and restrained him in the middle of the street. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The website of National Public Radio, NPR.org, has covered this story and tells us more. A cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors died after Los Angeles police repeatedly tased him in the middle of the street last week, according to police body camera footage and his family's account. Keenan Anderson, a 31-year-old high school teacher and father, was trying to get help after a traffic collision when he was chased, held down by multiple police officers and tased for over 90 seconds as he begged for help. Keenan Anderson's death, one of three fatalities stemming from the Los Angeles Police Department's use of force already this year, is sparking fresh calls for police reform in a city that's long been calling for racial justice. "I've been challenging law enforcement for the last 22 years, but I've never had someone this close in my family be killed by the police," Patrice Cullors told National Public Radio. "It's a devastating reality that any one of us could be impacted by the crisis that is the U.S. police system," she added. "We have to do something." The Los Angeles Police Department released edited body camera footage for all three of the deaths on Wednesday, 11th of January. Los Angeles Police Chief Michael Moore said they'd foregone the usual 45-day window for keeping the video private due to intense public interest. According to the accompanying police statement, the Los Angeles Police Department officer, whose name has not yet been released, first encountered Keenan Anderson at 3:38 p.m. on Tuesday, 3rd of January, when Anderson flagged him down to help with a traffic collision. The officer found Anderson running in the middle of the street and exhibiting erratic behavior, the account reads. Patrice Cullors, who watched the video with family just hours before its public release, says she recognizes a sense of fear on her cousin's face. "When you get in a car accident, your body is in shock," she said. "I don't know what my cousin was going through emotionally and mentally, but what I do know is that he got in a car accident. That's scary. And when you get in a car accident, you need help." Others involved in the collision said Anderson had caused it. LAPD Police Chief Moore said during a news conference on Wednesday, 11th of January. LAPD Police Chief Moore also said that Anderson had committed a felony hit and run and that another person involved in the collision said Anderson tried to steal a vehicle. The released video footage starts with the responding police officer ordering Anderson to get out of the street and up against the wall. Anderson, looking back at the scene of the accident, initially kneels with his hands up, shouting, "I didn't mean to, I'm sorry." After Anderson complies and later orders to sit, the police officer requests additional units to help with a DUI test. The 7 minutes the police officer waited for backup were not released as part of the video footage. The video footage after the 7 minutes shows Anderson standing up again, saying he needs to get some water, that he wanted to make sure people could see him. "You're putting a thing on me," he said, backing away from the police officer as the officer tells him to sit back down. Anderson proceeds to run into the street and crosses a busy intersection as a police officer pursues him on his motorcycle. Two more officers arrive on the scene, blocking some of the surrounding traffic. The police officers tell Anderson to get onto his stomach. When he finally fully complies, the police officers push him onto the ground and attempt to use their body weight to restrain him. One officer appears to put his elbow across Anderson's neck. "Please, please," Anderson yells, adding at one point, "They're trying to George Floyd me." Video footage shows officers threatening to tase Anderson at least 12 times before the police officer finally fires the taser. The officer then activates the taser on Anderson at least 6 consecutive times, at one point holding it against his back while the weapon buzzes for roughly 30 seconds straight. At Wednesday's news conference, the Los Angeles Police Department Chief Moore said only a single taser activation had occurred, elaborating later that he believed several attempts were ineffective. LAPD Police Chief Moore also said the department has no preset limit on the number of times a taser should be used in a situation. Following the tasing, video footage shows the police officers placing Anderson in handcuffs and ankle hobbles. At least 8 police officers appeared to be on the scene by the time Anderson was restrained. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors was killed by Los Angeles police after he got in a traffic accident and police officers who showed up repeatedly tased and restrained him in the middle of the street, according to body camera footage and his family's account. Video footage from the 3rd of January encounter released on Wednesday, 11th of January, showed that Keenan Anderson, a 31-year-old high school teacher and father, was begging for help as multiple police officers held him down, and at one point said, "They're trying to George Floyd me." One police officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. "My cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. He was killed," Patrice Cullors told The Guardian after watching the LAPD video footage. "Nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for his life. My cousin was scared for his life. He spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people in America. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him." A police officer who first arrived to the car collision at around 3:30 p.m. at Venice and Lincoln Boulevards found Anderson in the middle of the road saying, "Please help me." The police officer told him to go to the sidewalk and issued commands saying, "Get up against the wall." Anderson held his hands up, responding, "I didn't mean to, I'm sorry." Anderson complied with police officer's commands and sat down on the sidewalk. After a few minutes, he appeared to be concerned with the police officer's behavior, saying, "I want people to see me, and you're putting a thing on me." Eventually, Anderson started to flee, at which point the police officer chased him on his motorcycle, shouting, "Get down to the ground right now and turn over on your stomach." Anderson repeatedly responded, "Please help me, and they're trying to kill me," as multiple police officers arrived and held him down. One of them placed his elbow and body weight on Anderson's neck while he was lying with his back on the ground. At this point, the police officer standing above him shouted, "Turn over or I'm going to tase you." During the tasing, Anderson repeatedly said, "Help me," as the police officer told him to stop resisting. Paramedics later arrived at the scene and took him to hospital, where, according to the Los Angeles Police Department, he went into cardiac arrest. 4.5 hours later, he died. Patrice Cullors and other advocates have questioned why it was necessary for armed police to show up to a collision. "It was a traffic accident. Instead of treating him like a potential criminal, police should have called the ambulance," said Patrice Cullors. "If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths as well."
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Elon Musk is the richest man in the world and now owns Twitter. When he acquired it, there were high hopes that he'd be a genuine champion of free speech. There was an expectation in some quarters that the restrictions imposed by the previous incumbents on anti-imperialist and socialist accounts would be removed. But the reality has been somewhat different. So what should we make of the seemingly ambiguous and complex activities of his first few months in charge? We'll be discussing the implications of Elon Musk's Twitter takeover after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
Elon Musk, the world's richest man, bought Twitter last year. Since then, the company has been turned upside down. More than half the staff have left or have been forced out. The company has hemorrhaged money. Musk has claimed to be a champion of free speech and has vowed to make Twitter better by making the algorithms open source and defeating the spam bots. But is Musk a defender of free speech in general, or is it a case of except for Palestine? On the one hand, Musk has acted against censorship in restoring many Twitter accounts. He has annoyed the Zionist Anti-Defamation League. It called for an advertising boycott over the fact that many of the key moderation staff implementing anti-Palestinian censorship in cahoots with Zionist groups was sacked from Twitter. Musk has also allowed the publication of the so-called Twitter files. Among the many secrets revealed are the industrial-scale demands made by the FBI, CIA, and the Pentagon to remove independent journalists from Twitter and to protect covert propaganda accounts run by the US government. But Musk also seems close to Israel. In 2018, he traveled to Israel and met Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his private residence to discuss how to bring future technology to Israel. In recent weeks, Musk praised the foreign ministry's Twitter account, saying that more countries should use the platform like the Zionist entity does. He also appointed Barry Weiss to report on the Twitter files exposures. Weiss, like Musk, is a purported free speech defender, but being a Zionist, thinks nothing of targeting supporters of Palestine to be cancelled. Early indications are that Musk operates with this double standard too. Take the case of the Jisr Collective, supporters of the liberation of Palestine. Their account was suspended after a pro-Zionist troll falsely claimed the group was a terrorist group actively promoting and celebrating violence against Jews. Musk replied that such posts were not okay. The account was duly suspended. But these details aside, it is not so easy to evade the real pressures of the business environment, in which Zionist agents of influence are much more prominent than supporters of the Palestinians. The involvement of super agent Ari Emanuel in brokering the deal between Musk and Twitter is also notable, especially given his hardline Zionism. Emanuel has appeared at gala fundraisers for the Friends of the IDF organization, which splurges millions on supporting Zionist terror. This is hardly surprising given that his family has a long-standing involvement with Zionist terror. His father, Benjamin, smuggled guns for the Ergin terror gang. Even if Musk wanted to improve Twitter for supporters of Palestine, the objective conditions of the social media and elite business world and their systematic bias towards Zionism will likely make that a losing battle.
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Ibrahim Abul Esed. He's a UK-based Palestinian researcher and an activist, and he holds a master's degree in Middle Eastern studies, specialising in the formation of Palestine since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, what do you make of Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter, and what do you think it will mean for the Palestinian cause?
Well, in one way, it's been very good, because this is the thing which the Zionist groups didn't like. He sacked a whole slew of people who were involved in content moderation, and most of what they were doing was making sure that progressive voices weren't heard, especially pro-Palestinian voices. So that was really quite a progressive thing to do in some ways. Mm. He then restored a whole series of accounts, including a whole right-wing account, famously Donald Trump's account. But at the same time, he's also clearly vulnerable to the idea that supporting Palestinian liberation, is the same as hating Jews. Now, and of course it's not. And he's vulnerable to that kind of double standard that there is about supporting the idea that Palestine should be liberated.
Mm. Ibrahim, I mean, do you think Elon Musk's experience of growing up in apartheid South Africa could have an influence on his attitude towards Israeli apartheid today?
I think in today's day and age, all we have to do is look at his digital footprint on the internet to find out if he has a stated position on this topic. Regardless, we cannot deny the fact that Elon Musk grew up in South Africa at a time where apartheid was rife, whereby the urban layout of a society was dictated by structurally violent policies, segregating people on the basis of their race. And what we have today in occupied Palestine is non-Jews being segregated, essentially Palestinians, by mass, purely because of the fact of their religious identity. So we see very similar traits between that in apartheid South Africa and what Israel is doing today in Palestine. We see it through the checkpoint systems. We see it through the ID cards that Palestinians are issued, which is why you have South African activists such as Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, as well as Nelson Mandela, drawing upon these similarities. And with Israel's most recent government coming into power, Benjamin Netanyahu's government, who emphasized that he is going to prioritize and focus his efforts directed towards the Jewish people, we are only going to see more striking similarities between that of South Africa and that of Palestine today. I ask the audience the question, what of the non-Jews, what of the millions of Palestinians living in occupied territory in the West Bank, what of the millions that are living in the Gaza Strip? Mm. So, yes, mm. there are striking similarities between
yeah.
the two.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, obviously this programme exposes the role of the Israel lobby. I mean, so I wonder what you could say about the Israel lobby groups that are already at work inside Twitter today.
Well, prior to Musk taking over, there was a pattern of activity whereby there was a Twitter safety council, and there were a whole series of groups brought in to advise Twitter on hate speech, on which accounts should be suspended. Now, these were dominated in the case of conflict areas by Zionist groups. There was one Muslim group which was itself very close to Zionism. So there was no voice in there at all defending the idea of Palestinian rights. So it was a very strong influence of Zionism in terms of content moderation from outside groups, but also it seems from inside groups, because there were many people who had previously worked in the CIA and the Pentagon, including one guy who in the UK who remains part of the 77th Brigade, the British Army's propaganda operation. He was involved in content moderation on the Middle East, and he was one of the ones who was sacked. So there was a very strong grip in there of pro-Zionist messages in relation to Twitter. But now most of those people have been sacked, and that's the new territory we're in, because it looks like the possibility of a new freedom in Twitter, but it's not working out quite that way, as we saw in the film with the example of the Jisr Collectives, whose account has been suspended for no good reason.
Mm. I mean, Ibrahim, it seems that Twitter's continuing to censor Palestinian groups and indeed their supporters. I mean, do you think Elon Musk could still make the changes that many people hope for, or?
Quite frankly, I don't believe this somewhat saviour is coming to amplify our voices on a somewhat crusader mission, amplifying our voices on Twitter because of our campaigning for the human rights of Palestinian people, as we clearly see accounts such as Noura Erekat being permanently suspended, if I'm not mistaken, but now after successful pressure, her account has now been restored. As long as individuals and organizations continue to platform online to defend and call for the human rights and expose the Israeli war crimes being committed in Palestine, we are going to see the Israeli lobby use its utmost effort on such platforms to silence individuals, which we have seen with Noura Erekat being one, and as the film mentioned earlier, other organizations.
I mean, it's probably worth pressurizing Musk, though, isn't it, given his
alleged commitment to freedom of speech and sort of hold him to account on that, do you think, or not?
And I believe that will be a testament of time.
Yeah.
In the sense, yeah, if in, when we're focusing on Palestine, with this new Israeli government that have said individuals within the government calling to be the landlords of their very own country, will only be a testament of time to find out whether individuals, as well as organisations that continue to campaign for the human rights belonging to an oppressed people, will have their voices silenced.
Well, look, David, I mean... Just tell us what the story is with the middleman for this Twitter deal, Ari Emanuel.
So Emanuel is referred to as a Hollywood super agent. He represents a huge list of A-list celebrities in LA and Hollywood. But he was called in to broker the deal when it looked like the deal was going south. Musk put in the offer and then withdrew the offer, and Emanuel was brought in to broker the deal. Now, he's close to Musk. Musk was at his wedding earlier this year, and indeed went on holiday with him in a Greek island off Mykonos as well. So, and he is a part of the Emanuel family. He has two brothers, Zeke and Ram, both of whom are quite prominent in U.S. politics, both of them strong Zionists, all three of them in the Democratic Party. But Rahm Emanuel is so hardline on Israel that Donald Trump actually funded one of his political campaigns. Yeah. But Ari is the agent in this case. Their father was a guy called Benjamin, right, who was in the Ergun, who was involved in arms smuggling for the Ergun, and allegedly involved in various assassinations and terror attacks in the process of the creation of the State of Israel. And Ari Emanuel himself, of course, regularly is involved with the Friends of the IDF and raising huge sums of money that they raise at their gala dinners. They spend millions of dollars every year to the IDF to support Israeli war crimes. So there's a clear sense there that in the milieu in which he operates, there's a very strong Zionist influence.
What about its alliance with this character, Murray Weiss? I mean, what do you know about that?
Well, that's more complicated, I think, because she was brought in to do the Twitter files, and there's been some really interesting stuff in the Twitter files, and it's well worth having a look.
Which, obviously, a credit, I suppose, to Musk in actually releasing
those. Indeed. It's worth having a look at in depth. But she quickly fell out with him, right, over his statements about journalists, and so they got into a big spat. So although she's kind of she sort of cancelled herself from the New York Times, claiming there was all this anti-Semitism, you know, usual fake allegations. But then she's now been appointed by Musk to this role, and very quickly fell out with him about his arguments over journalists. So it's an interesting thing to see how this develops.
It'll be interesting how it develops. But we're going to just pause there for a moment because we want to just have a look now at a report on how Elon Musk's been involved in launching satellites for the Zionist regime.
From his very inception, Elon Musk's project SpaceX was very close to the CIA, enjoying support and investment from Mike Griffin, president at venture capital firm InQtel. But InQtel is not any venture capital firm. It's a CIA operation that cultivates companies to work with a national security state. Mike Griffin later went on to NASA, where he further assisted Musk in his ascent. Over the years, Musk's company has made billions on contracts to transport spy satellites, which aid in drone warfare and the gathering of military intelligence. One such customer has been U.S. arms firm Lockheed Martin, which gave Musk $500 million in 2018 to launch their GPS system. SpaceX was contracted by the U.S. Air Force to launch the command satellite, through which it maps targets. Musk also launched the spy satellites for the National Reconnaissance Office, which are used by both the NSA and CIA. Elon Musk later assisted the NATO proxy war in Ukraine by providing his Starlink satellites for use by the Ukrainian military against the Russian army. It is believed the satellites allow the Ukrainian forces to target using thermal imaging, even in harsh conditions. We now also know that Musk and his Starlink satellites are active in the regime change operation against Iran. When U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken commented on the need for the U.S. government to aid the flow of information in Iran, Musk personally responded to the tweet with the words, "Activating Starlink." He later tweeted the words, "Approaching 100 Starlinks active in Iran." Musk's collaboration with Israel against the resistance axis has taken an ominous turn. Recently, Musk's company, SpaceX, quietly launched spy satellites for the gathering of military intelligence for an Israeli intelligence company called ImageSat International. The CEO of the company, Noam Sigal, is a current reserve in the Israeli Air Force. The chief of marketing at the company is Barak Salamin, an active duty officer in the Israeli Air Force. The company is full of former and current Israeli military figures, as well as former employees of Israeli arms company Elbit Systems. Musk's collaborator ImageSat International has been a key component of Israeli airstrikes on Syria, and it's likely this launch serves a similar purpose. Both the company and the Israeli embassy in the US publicly thanked Musk and SpaceX on Twitter for facilitating the launch, a fitting tribute.
David, Elon Musk's SpaceX company is portrayed as a benign project that's focused on enhancing our understanding of the solar system and the wider universe. But I wonder if you could say something about its role in developing a kind of global surveillance infrastructure.
Well, let's remember that Musk's fortune is based in part on huge sums of money from the military-industrial complex. Now, whatever your views on politics or free speech, and he appears to have some kind of vaguely libertarian ideas, that's an anchor for how you will conduct yourself. You can't leave that anchor behind, because that's where you get your wealth from. So this is the key thing here. We've got to look at where the money comes from and how he's anchored economically as opposed to ideologically to the military-industrial complex. Now, the military-industrial complex in this case is predominantly U.S. imperialism and is involved in global surveillance of populations which might pose a threat to U.S. interests. Now, of course, that's, as we speak today, in Iran, in Syria, in Somalia, and various other places, right? So that's what his interests are, even though he might have a set of ideas which cut against those interests in some respects. So that's where we should be directing attention. And you see that in the involvement with the Israelis, you know, putting up satellites which are allowing Israeli, effectively, war crimes in the thousands of bombing raids they've done. There's 1,000 now on Syria in the last few years. These are against international law. They shouldn't be occurring. And Musk is facilitating them.
Mm, interesting, yeah. I mean, of course, and I remember when the coup in Bolivia took place, he tweeted out, you know, we will coup whoever we want to, didn't he? Which sort of gives away some of his where his sympathies perhaps lie. But Abraham, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what you know about this organisation, ImageSat International, that Elon Musk has worked with recently.
So essentially, ImageSat International is an Israeli intelligence firm, surveillance firm, whereby it's made up of, as the film showed us, members that have illustrious history, illustrious backgrounds in the Israeli military and private arms Israeli companies, such as that of Elbit Systems. And essentially what ImageSat International is that it takes pictures in colour, and has been found in the past of taking pictures within Syria and providing coordinates to the Israeli Air Force to then later carry out strikes. As David just mentioned, in the last 5 years, at least 1,000 airstrikes have been carried out by Israel into Syria, which only makes us question how many other countries in that region alone are they surveying, spying on, providing coordinates for, not only within the Middle East, but across the entire world.
Mm. I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Musk's assisting the Israeli war on the axis of resistance by launching these satellites containing hardware made by the notorious Elbit Systems. I mean, and we've covered the campaigns against Elbit on this show on a number of occasions before, but I wonder whether you could sort of update us really on what the latest is on the struggle against Elbit in the UK.
Well, just in case for first-time viewers, Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest private arms companies. They produce the drones that survey and kill Palestinians, and Palestine Action, which is a organization that carries out direct action against Elbit Systems, is carrying out the Shut Down Elbit campaign, whereby they have already shut down a factory as well as Elbit's HQ in the heart of central London, and have cost Israel's war machine millions by applying pressure upon the pressure points of this monolithic structure, as it somewhat appears to be. As it currently stands, there are many activists within Palestine Action that have caught this month and throughout the year of 2023, and we must ensure that we do our utmost effort to support these individuals that have cost Israel's, one of Israel's largest private arms companies, millions. Mm. It's held them accountable to the countless war crimes it has committed in the Gaza Strip, the countless children, women, men, elderly, yeah, as well as those retaining physical and mental disabilities. Yeah. So we must be there as an act of support.
Sure, sure. I mean, David, Musk's involved in the regime change operation in Iran, isn't he, as well?
Well, he has this Starlink thing, isn't it, which is a means of communications which bypasses the internet or mobile phone signals to enable those who are involved in the riots and the subversion in Iran to try and communicate with Western sources. So, yes, he's been involved in that, and that's been, probably quite important in the attempt to foment the riots in Iran, but of course, overall, those attempts have failed. I mean, there's an attempt to do this in the last few months, but these have now failed, and it's not looking like it was a success. But certainly, he was involved in that, and that's an indication again of his orientation towards the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about the Starlinks that you mentioned there. I mean, he's also had some input into the war in Ukraine as well, hasn't he? I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, and the same thing there, the Starlink's there. But the interesting thing in Ukraine was his kind of ambiguous position on this. He's much more sympathetic to Russia, it seems, than you would expect from someone from that kind of background. And he threatened the Ukrainians that he was going to withdraw the Starlinks unless they paid for them. And they were outraged at this, the idea that they'd have to pay. And they were also complaining they weren't working properly. He said, well, you want them to work properly? Pay me the money. Yeah. And that's an interesting little kind of detail. But yes, he has been involved in that. And that appears to be continuing. But nevertheless, there's an ambiguity there about his relationship with Russia.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I mean, Ibrahim, I mean, looking forward as a young Palestinian journalist, I mean, I wonder whether you could tell us what your hopes are for Twitter as a means of expression.
I think first thing we have to do, Chris, is understand the reality that we live in today and how likely could there be a Palestinian journalist from a working class background or anybody that isn't white, upper class, a male, within that demographic, using such platforms, whether it be that to even go to university, to particular occupations and particular jobs. I think what we really need to do is understand that we're in a particular position of power, and it could go even more some. I'm not trying to say that the position we're in now is, I'm happy with it, but what we have to do is use Twitter and the tools that we have, capitalize on them, amplify our voices, ensure that this reality in our parents' generation alone was not a likelihood that could have happened, and how globalized we are and how connected we are in today's day and age. What is our excuse? When we are seeing people gather en masse in millions of numbers before an age of WhatsApp, before an age of Instagram, before an age where I can find out the war crimes that are happening in the Gaza Strip just before I lay my head to rest. What is our excuse in towards mobilizing? What is our excuse into using it as a means of expression?
Yeah. I mean, David, just finally and briefly, I wonder whether you could, just following up on, what Ibrahim was saying there and just Twitter in general and being used as a tool, but it's also been used in a kind of negative way to kind of close down, pro-Palestinian voices. I wonder whether you could maybe just list some of the organisations. We've touched on this a little bit in the past, of organisations like CST and so on, and the actions that, that they've taken, lobbying Twitter to try and close down, limit people like ourselves, you and I.
Well, I think Twitter and social media in general is an ambiguous thing. These are dominated by Western corporations who have over-close relationships with both the military-industrial complex and with intelligence agencies, and thus, also with Zionist lobby groups. But there are alternatives emerging. Alternatives emerging in Russia and China and various places, and that's also critically important for the future. But lastly, the thing I would say is remember that mobile phones are also used for surveillance, and they're also used for targeting people in situations of conflict. So, we can't be, too optimistic about the possibilities of technology because they have negative...
Definitely pros and cons. Unfortunately, as ever, we've run out of time, but I'm afraid so we're going to have to leave it there. I hope you found this programme informative again, and I want to thank our guests, Ibrahim Abul Asad, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
In California, at least 19 people have died as the storms continue to batter the region, leading to widespread flooding, mudslides, and power outages. The National Weather Service says large portions of Central California have received over half of their annual normal precipitation in just the past 2 weeks, and more rain incoming. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says 34 million Californians are under a flood watch. Despite the devastating impacts, few media outlets have drawn a connection between the historic weather and human-induced climate change. In this regard, we have taken a look at World Media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more.